Greet you in Jesus' name. We'll have to try and bring our thoughts closer, much closer to earth, when we think about restoring the erring brother. Speaks of someone that is close to us, or was close to us. We can fall in character because of pride. We can fall morally because of indulgence. And we can fall emotionally because of many and various factors in our life. Since our title does not define what type of error or what type of fall, we're going to look at the work of redemption through a broad lens tonight. And I would like to make one disclaimer, and that is that I don't know how to restore an erring brother. But my Father in heaven does know how. And he knows how that he can use each one of our gifts, whatever that may be, to assist in restoring an erring brother. The work of restoration is, in spiritual things, is a process where we don't see the results immediately. Many times it can be a rather discouraging process. And maybe we'll never live to see the results. We might actually pass off the scenes before the restoration comes to fruition. But the work of restoration is a united effort of God's people using various gifts and talents. If I had a big rock up here, and I had a sledgehammer, and I would ask each one of you to come up and give it two whacks. Give it two whacks, or give it three whacks. And on the 100th whack, the rock was split open. Which hit did the breaking? Was it the last two? Was it the first two? Or was it all of them? Can we be Christians tonight and not be involved in making attempts at restoration? Even if we feel our hit that we gave was just a tap. It just seems like, what good did that word do? What good did that question do? What good did that befriending do? Can we be Christians and not making attempts, refusing to help, to restore someone who has fallen around us? Turn to Galatians chapter 6. I'd like to read verses 1 to 3. I assume this is likely where the thoughts were going when the committee assigned this, but they didn't tell me so. But I'd like to base our thoughts tonight off of this. Galatians 6, verses 1 to 3. Brethren, if a man be overtaken in a fault, ye which are spiritual, restore such an one in the spirit of meekness, considering thyself, lest thou also be tempted. Bear ye one another's burdens, and so fulfill the law of Christ. For if a man think himself to be something, when he is nothing, he deceiveth himself. We are focused tonight on helping someone that is from among us, or was from among us. Someone who sidestepped, someone who erred, someone who deviated from the way of truth by a choice or a series of choices. And they're currently in a condition that is fallen. They need to help to get back up. Usually when a brother errs to the point of disconnecting himself from God and God's people, usually there's not one isolated incident that is a complete fault of it. It many times involves an assortment of grievances and wounds, sometimes by professing people of God. And these grievances and wounds just bombard the thoughts to the point that the brother or the sister feels justified to do what they're doing, to defy the promptings of the Holy Spirit, and do what they want to do. And when we get involved, we see their fallenness, we see their woundedness, we see a person that needs help. But many times we don't understand the depths of their beliefs that they're holding, what they're believing about life, what they're believing about Christianity, and how they're going about protecting themselves from more hurt. And we may be viewed as just another predator in their life, the next person that's going to hurt them if they open up to us. And we may feel like we're trying to rescue a wild tomcat or someone that does not want our help. It will likely feel like that at times. Proverbs 18, verse 19 says, "A brother offended is harder to be won than a strong city, and their contentions are like the bars of a castle." I had an experience a year or two ago to be involved in helping a young woman from out of the area who found herself in a unfortunate situation that could have used some masculine help. And because of some connections, indirect connections to our family, my son-in-law and myself were trying to help her out of her dilemma a bit. And I never realized in that process, I never realized the conflict that was going through that girl's mind. And she confided in someone after the fact that, "I never trusted a man before." Even in the midst of needing help, it was hard for her to let someone get that close, to get that involved. I don't know what her experiences were in her past with men, but there was a wall there that was hard to penetrate. Hard for her to allow to be broken down and have trust even when in need. So helping an erring brother or sister can involve a tangle of personal biases, perspectives, beliefs, and we are clueless. But they're firmly formed. They're like bars in a castle in this individual's mind. And they believe they're setting themselves up again for a repeat. The erring brother likely has reasons he is making the choices he is. And the surface things that we see have tentacles that go far deeper and very far underground. The youth boy who buys that big-rimmed, slammed-down, cambered hatchback is buying more than just an uncomfortable ride. I watch some of those cars driving and I see the headlights bouncing and I have to think what their teeth are doing inside the car. But they endure it. They put up with it. Because, well, it's cool. But why? But why? Why is the absurd cool? Well, they're likely on a search. They're likely on a search for belonging. They're likely on a search for identity. And they see this car as a way of helping them get that. Get inclusion. Maybe he was raised in a home that held a conservative stance. And he bought the car to loudly proclaim that I'm not at one with my parents' values. Or my family's values. And we can, as helpful Christians, we can look at that and we can see a lack of common sense and a waste of money, and we can attack the thing. We can jab at the thing. Why would you drive something so impractical? How stupid. Rough riding, hard to get in and out. The tires don't wear even. And we can attack what they're doing and miss getting a connection to their heart. Because what they're doing has very much deeper connections than what we see on the surface. Maybe we see the studded tongue and the nose rings and the lip piercings, and it's painful. And we say, why did you ever go there? Why would you ever do that? Why would you ever endure that kind of pain? That's not the way you were brought up. That's not the way your parents taught you. The goal of restoration, I believe, needs to be to try and connect at a heart level and get to the heart issues and the surface things. Let God deal with the surface things. When we see error, we see actions. We see that individual that traded his faithful marriage partner for a fling, and we pity the family, and it wants to make us angry inside. He traded freedom of gospel simplicity for a complicated worldly bondage, and we say, why? But behind these actions is usually a heart cry. Something is hurting very deeply. Something is very empty inside. And we have to head for that if we're going to begin restoration. I was listening to someone talk recently about an audiobook that they listened to on how the FBI negotiates with kidnappers. The subject was being discussed because of the kidnapping. And it was interesting what he shared about what he learned, how they use megaphones, they use any means possible to communicate to the person that's in hiding. And what was interesting is that they appeal to the insecurities. If they can get a voice somehow into the kidnapper's realm that he can hear, then they appeal to the kidnapper's insecurities. Because when a kidnapper takes on a kidnapping, he makes himself very, very vulnerable. He's hoping the townspeople don't turn against him. He's hoping that he can keep his control. And things could untangle and things could unravel really fast. But, you know, we tend to look at somebody like that as very tough. And you got to be hard. You got to come in there with the same amount of muscle and bigger guns. But that's not the way they go about it. They appeal to the individual's fears. And as they appeal to those fears, they try and help them come to logic, good logic, of why they should let this person go free. If we are going to try and help the fallen brother, we must discover the deep hurts, the lies they are believing, the fears that they are living with, where they're getting the justification to their actions, and then try and bring biblical perspective to it. These strongholds that are deep down inside, that are walled up like the bars of a castle, and try and bring Bible perspective behind the scenes. Behind that dating app that we discovered on their phone. And we say, why would a Christian young man ever want to go there? But behind that, maybe a series of turndowns from girls that they asked. Or maybe they're justifying themselves in the fact that they identified under a Christian category and they're not necessarily going after the bad girls. Or have themselves believing that their real life challenges and relationships justifies an attempt with a stranger through technology, that maybe that will work better. And they become an erring brother. They're led away by these things that, these misguided concepts and their hurts and their longings. I'd like to look at some things that Jesus showed us and how to connect with people on deeper levels in an effort to bring restoration to their life. You can turn to John chapter 4, the familiar passage, the woman at the well, the Samaritan, and how Jesus allowed his humanity to be a connector and build up a conversation there with her. John 4, starting at verse 6, says, now Jacob's well was there. Jesus, therefore, being wearied with his journey, sat thus in the well, and it was about the sixth hour. There cometh a woman of Samaria to draw water. Jesus saith unto her, give me to drink, for his disciples were gone away unto the city to buy meat. Then saith the woman of Samaria unto him, how is it that thou, being a Jew, askest this drink of me, which am a woman of Samaria? for the Jews have no dealings with the Samaritans. Jesus embraced his humanity, and he laid down all airs to build a bridge for communication. Jesus didn't need her help to get water. If he really would have really wanted water, he could have got it. He was able to take a couple loaves and feed multitudes. But he embraced his humanity, and he used that as a connector into this woman's life. And this woman picked up very quickly that Jesus was not a typical Jew. He was okay. Excuse me. He was okay to ask a Samaritan for a drink, to be seen in public with a Samaritan. He used his weariness to make that connection. It says he being wearied with his journey. He allowed fatigue and thirst and a lack of tools, earthly tools, to draw water, to be an impetus for connection. What he really wanted to tell her was who he was and that she needs his water, his living water. That's really what he wanted to tell her. But he allowed himself, his body, to be a tool to make that connection. If we want to restore the erring brother, we need to look for ways to make connections. And sometimes that connection has nothing to do with spiritual things. It might be asking them if they could come and help us fix or do something that we could use a little help with, or maybe we're not good at, or maybe it's us offering to help them. Maybe it's going on a walk. To help the erring brother isn't all about sitting on solid wooden chairs in some sterile environment, but it's about making connection. Somehow making connection and laying down all airs and be real and genuine and admit that we don't have it all together in all areas either. But how can we help you? Sometimes I think in Mennonite circles we can just button all up and just give that air, we got it all together and you don't. Sometimes just being honest is a good way to connect. And let them know that they're not weird. They might have made some bad choices, but they're not weird. We genuinely love them in spite of where they are in life at the moment. We genuinely love them. They need to discover that you are a friend who cares about them. And you're not just coming in as Mr. Fix-It. But Galatians 6 does warn us that while we need to build bridges, we need to be careful because bridge building can be dangerous work. Bridge building means exposure. And exposure can bring temptation. And we which are strong are supposed to make that exposure, but be careful in the process. Consider thyself, lest thou also be tempted. There are boundaries to how far we maybe can go as we know ourselves. How can we believe we're spiritual and have something to offer but still have a spirit of meekness that connects in a way that redemption can be realized? We need to be humble. In the whole process, we need to be humble. The spirit of meekness understands that very likely, if we would have walked in their shoes, if we would have their DNA, very likely we would have made similar choices. Even if we have trouble wrapping our mind around how they ever got to where they are, we haven't walked in their exact shoes. When meekness is alive, burden bearing can be alive too. In verse 2 it says, "Bear ye one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ." And I believe this word picture here of "bear ye one another's burdens" is lost in modern American culture. I'm told in Bible times they had men that were known as porters. These men would stand outside the city gate, waiting for the wagon trains and merchants to come with their stuff, their wares to sell in the city. And it was their job. They would wait there, and they were the transport. They were the human bodies, the human flatbeds, the human whatever, reefers, whatever you want to call them, to take it from the city gate into center city. And these porters, these merchants, wanted to make the most out of every trip that a porter made into center city. So they would load them up. They would just pile it on and tie it on and shrink wrap it on or whatever they had, or however they did it back then. But they would end up with huge burdens. And they would get so much to take that to center city. And the weaker porters, of course, the bigger build men, they got loaded with bigger loads, but they could maybe make it farther than the weaker men. And the weaker porters learned that if they admitted their weakness and they turned their backs toward each other, with a load like that, they couldn't sit down or they wouldn't have got back up. But they learned that there was a way to rest if they would just lean their loads against each other and just rest for a bit and then just tilt front again, and then they could keep going and get to center city, or at least farther. It says, "Bear ye one another's burdens, and so fulfill the law of Christ." I believe if we want to help the erring brother, we have to admit our own weakness and help bear their burden. We're nothing special. It takes humility. Number two, to restore a fallen brother, you must lay down the reason it happened and focus on the rescue. Maybe it's my carnality, but there can be sometimes as things well up within me. I know they knew better. There's something inside of me wants to just hold back on the rescue. If it's bad choices, they knew better. It was circumstances that we believe were not outside of their control, that they could have made better choices. And we sometimes feel like we don't need to hurry the process because they knew better. This was not an innocence. And they need to do some reaping. And there is a law of sowing and reaping. I'm not minimizing that with what I'm saying. But to be redemptive, we must keep in mind God did not place us here to be the judge and jury of the sentence in their life. That is God's to do. He placed us here to do our part to restore a relationship with Him in spite of what happened and how it went down. When a firefighter or an EMT gets to a situation demanding their attention, they may not waste much time ascertaining what got the victim into this situation. It doesn't really matter. If the mother left a candle on in the house and accidentally burned the house down, or deliberately lit the house, that doesn't really matter at the moment. There's a rescue that needs to happen. If they're going to salvage the neighbor's house and protect others around, they must get right to it. And we have to keep that in mind. For every fallen brother, there's influences going out, and there's a rescue that needs to happen as soon as possible. What does true restoration look like? Well, it involves a roadmap to redemption that is attainable for the benefit of the fallen person and those that are impacted by his or her choices. The road back can look very overwhelming to someone who comes to the end and realizes how far they deviated. And we need to, in that restoration process, we need to break it back, break it down into steps that are attainable for them to retrace their steps. And it's quite typical for the person that's erring to simply want to get back to the place where they were before sin overtook them. And it's our desire to help them get there. But it is important to realize that restoration involves more than just that, more than just getting back to the things they were doing before and just trying to patch everything up and say, okay, let's pretend it never happened. Because there are others many times that they impacted. The highest priority is that we help them restore their fellowship with God. That's the highest priority. That needs to be our focus. And when we get a grasp on that vertical disconnect and focus on that, the horizontal disconnects will start coming together. And there will be humility comes over them, and there will be a desire for restitution and those things that come along with repentance when the fellowship with God is restored. And getting them back again into the fast lane is not our primary concern, but restitution and their ability to retrace their steps carefully and heal the things and straighten out the stones that they overturned in the process, if we can, and help them do that. Zacchaeus is just an amazing man to me, that when he realized the extent of his extortion as a tax collector, he volunteered to repay many times over the pain that he caused other people. Helping the erring to get the focus off of just getting back to normal, to doing their part in helping the offended heal, can be a huge undertaking, as the desire for normalcy is so strong. So many people, after being caught in sin, want to deal with it quickly and just get their lives back again. And this is not always possible. Sometimes they need help to understand the feelings of others that they may have trampled down in the process, and give others time to come along. And there is a possibility that sometimes it's a new normal and never exactly the same normal as it was before. And we need to help them to prepare for that and to adjust to that. Maybe the sin caused an issue with family members, maybe the spouse, maybe the children. And we need to carefully help them wade through all that. We need to address all the parameters so that trust can grow, and that we lower the possibility of a reoccurrence. We want to make sure it's a safe return and that parameters are in place that will safeguard them in the future. Helping them with patience in the process of redemption. And this can be a very frustrating part of restoration. It may take longer than they wish, and they don't understand why they've repented now, and they're very sorry for what they did, and why it has to be quite so difficult a process. I have memories of going with a brother. I think it was more than one day, if I remember correctly. It was years ago. He was a very, very rebellious youth, and he came to the place of true repentance, and he desired to make restitution and go around to the many people that in his community that he had influenced wrongly, and he wanted to make it right. And I went with him on that journey, and it was a beautiful thing. It was a beautiful thing to see him asking for their forgiveness and them extending forgiveness to him. How much more the Father in heaven wants to do that and wants us to be a part in that process in people's lives, to forgive them, to wash their slate clean, to help them on a path forward in a much better way. Number three pointer I have is use word pictures that reframe the actions of the erring brother to jog their perspective of themselves when possible. Use word pictures. Sometimes if we frame what's happening in their life, reframe it in a different picture, sometimes that can jog their thinking. We were in a conference, we were talking about something, and I used an illustration completely different than what we were talking about. And everybody just laughed, and they're, "No, it's not like that." I said, "I got your attention." And they said, "Yeah, you did." Sometimes we can use that technique when we're helping the erring brother. Turn to 2 Samuel chapter 12. The Bible gives a good example of this in action. 2 Samuel chapter 12. David here is the one that is the fallen brother. He fell into sin with Bathsheba. He fell hard, he fell far, he tried to cover his tracks, he killed her husband in the process. And there was a man named Nathan that was given the job of going to David and trying to help him realize how seriously
he transgressed. And let's look what Nathan did here. 2 Samuel 12, verse 1, "And the Lord sent Nathan unto David, and he came unto him and said unto him, There were two men in one city, the one rich and the other poor. The rich man had exceeding many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing save one little ewe lamb, which he had brought and nourished up, and it grew up together with him and with his children. It did eat of his own meat and drank of his own cup and lay in his bosom and was unto him as a daughter. And there came a traveler unto the rich man, and he spared to take him of his own flock and of his own herd to dress for the wayfaring man that was come unto him. But he took the poor man's lamb and dressed it for the man that was come to him. And David's anger was greatly kindled against the man. And he said to Nathan, As the Lord liveth, the man that hath done this thing shall surely die. And he shall restore the lamb fourfold because he did this thing, and because he had no pity. And Nathan said to David, Thou art the man. Thus saith the Lord God of Israel, I anointed thee king over Israel, and I delivered thee out of the hand of Saul. And I'll stop reading there. But Nathanael, the prophet, is an inspiration to me in how to help an erring brother. He framed a picture. He framed a story of a lamb instead of a story of a man's wife. And that can be powerful. David got the message. He wasn't really thinking that this was about him. But when he realized it, it got to his heart. I vividly remember sitting alongside someone who was trying to help a woman from an abused background. The woman had moved on in life. She had married a wonderful husband and had several beautiful children, but she fell into a victim mentality that seemed almost unshakable. Her husband adored her, but she could not allow herself to feel her husband's adoration, and it became a big problem in their relationship. And the person that was trying to help her sat very quietly and listened as she talked, and her hands were moving and she was trying to explain things. And then they ventured a word picture, and they said to her, they said, you feel like a beautiful vase that has been shattered into 1,000 pieces and glued back together, and you can never ever be beautiful again, don't you? And the reaction that the look and the reaction that came over that woman's face as she pondered that picture, it just connected with her heart. And that was the moment she broke down and she sobbed, and the Kleenex box came out, and it just resonated. And then the counselor had something to build on. They had something, they had a foundation that they could build on, that here was a woman that believed that she was not beautiful anymore, even though God had forgiven and healed her and made her very beautiful, even though there was a work that she could do. And I was a little taken aback at how that picture resonated with her. But it found a common ground that they could build on, and it helped shape their counseling. She had a perspective of herself that was demoralizing her spiritually and physically. She was living as a perpetual ruined and fallen sister in a barred castle instead of a forgiven and saved child of the king living in a palace that God had restored. So much of the work of restoration is to help people out of their perspectives of the bondage that they're in. They all have perspectives. They may not be right, but it's their perspective. I said at the outstart that many times error has its roots in circumstances that people may or may not have a lot of control over. Somebody offended them. Somebody refused to befriend them. Things happened that caused deep hurts, and not that that is an excuse to sin, but it so many times becomes a reason for them to enter into sin or to keep sinning. Things happen and we have our logic, our perspective of what went wrong, and we believe there's nothing we could have done differently. We are a victim of other people's slander, a victim of other people's failures. And many times part of helping in restoration is is helping them to see through different eyes that possibly they have a part in the failure. Maybe it's only 15%, but it is a part. And they need to reckon with that part. For there to be 100% redemption, they got to come to grips with the fact that there was a 15% failure on their part, even if the responsibility is more heavily on the other side. We are not responsible for what others did wrong in a circumstance, but we are responsible for what we did wrong, no matter how small our portion of the piece of the pie. And sometimes the work of redemption is just helping them to see that. Number five, don't try and be the man or woman in the cape that flies in with all the answers. Don't try and be that person. Be the person that listens. Trying to get a grasp on their perspective. Ask lots of questions. Try and search for answers together. Try and discover where the train left the track and where the repairs are needed to prevent the reoccurrence. If we do the same things tomorrow that we did today, we will likely get the same results tomorrow as we did today. It's a simple logic of life. Number six, be honest if you are not the best fit and let others help. We don't have to understand the depth of their fall to be on a rescue mission, but there is something empowering when we realize the person that is trying to help us has a grasp on our experience, understands a little bit where we are, maybe from a different vantage point. But there are some times I was trying to help someone in a struggle and realized I maybe am not the right person, the right personality, or maybe I don't understand the depth of their struggle enough to really connect as deeply as this person needs. Don't be intimidated by that, but allow others to help in the recovery effort. Welcome others in. We are not out to make trophies to sit on a shelf because there's no competition in the Lord's work. The rock illustration, we're all here to tap in any way we can to try and bring about the results that we desire. And we need to be careful that we don't become an erring brother that is being too protective and isolating others out of the rescue effort, that we become the erring brother trying to help the erring brother. Number seven, sometimes part of restoration is helping the elder brother accept the prodigal back home. We know the story of the prodigal, how offended the elder brother was that his younger brother got all this fanfare. Sometimes part of restoration is helping the elder brother accept the prodigal back home. And I say this last point because it's something that happened in my youth. I remember as a youth, one of my friend's dads failed in a way that brought a reproach to the church, and it ended up with the law being involved, which was maybe a bit rare back then, I don't know. But I remember on more than one occasion, long after the failure, counsel was taken in the church to receive this brother back into fellowship. The ministry was recommending that he be received back in fellowship, but I guess due process, it was asked for congregational approval because of the nature of the offense. And I don't know what percentage it took to carry or anything, but I felt so sorry for that man because at more than one occasion, counsel was taken and it was denied that he is allowed back in yet. And something felt wrong with that picture. The church started to feel like a cruel place to me instead of a forgiving place. Now you say, but no, wait, you just said that it takes time to bring people back. Yes, it does. But there's a point that we can bring a lot more sorrow into if they have truly forgiven, if they have tried hard to undo their wrongs. Let's do our part in welcoming back the erring brother and welcome them back into the family and forgive them. Until that can happen, restoration is not complete on this side of eternity. May God give us wisdom as we endeavor to help the erring person that's in our life. God bless you.